I will be back in just a moment with Elizabeth Holtzman talking about impeachment. This is a little Ani DeFranco here for you.
Here's a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation, under the stone-cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses and doctors who daily provide women with a choice, who stand down a threat the size of Oklahoma City just to listen to a young woman's voice. Here's a toast to all those folks on death row right now, awaiting the executioner's guillotine, who are shackled there with dread and can only escape into their heads to find peace in a form of a dream. Peace in a form of a dream. Peace in the form of a dream. Cause take away our PlayStations and we are a third world nation, under the thumb of some blue blood royal son who stole the Oval Office and that phony election. I mean, it don't take a weatherman to look around and see the weather. Jeb said he'd deliver Florida, folks, and boy, did he ever. And we hold these truths to be self-evident. Number one, George W. Bush is not president. Number two, America is not a true democracy. And number three, the media is not fooling me.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My name is Andrew Geller, for folks joining us in the second half here. We started out talking with Jennifer Van Bergen about the unitary executive theory of governance, and we're now going to take a look at the issue of impeachment, both as an abstract concept and a necessary immediate action regarding the state of the United States government. My guest to talk about this is Elizabeth Holtzman. She is an attorney focusing on government relations at all levels and in litigation. She's a graduate of Harvard Law School back in 1965. She's admitted to the New York State Bar, the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and district courts for the Southern and Eastern Districts of New York. She was elected to Congress in 1972 and served several terms. And she was, I suppose, in a way fortunate and maybe not so fortunate to actually sit on the House Judiciary Committee that impeached Richard Nixon. And we are going to talk about impeachment. Welcome to you and thank you for joining us, Elizabeth.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate that very much.
Now, you have the cover story in the January 30th issue, and I don't think that's quite current anymore because of the time lag with magazine cycles, but the January 30 issue of The Nation magazine cover story, The Impeachment of George W. Bush. And I just want to paraphrase a little from a couple paragraphs at the front end as lead into my first question for you. You write that you've been deeply troubled by Bush's breathtaking scorn for international treaty obligations, the United Nations Charter, the Geneva Conventions, greatly disturbed by the torture scandals and violation of U.S. criminal law at the highest levels of the government. And then compounding this, evidence that George W. Bush and his administration deliberately misled the country into an aggressive war in Iraq. But it wasn't until, you write, the NSA domestic spying scandal that, quote, I felt the same sinking feeling in my stomach as I did during Watergate. Why is that?
Well, because, you know, impeachment is not something that you ever undertake lightly, should never be undertaken lightly, because you're overturning the elected will of the people. And in a democracy, that happens only under the most extraordinary and extreme circumstances. And we learned that during the Nixon impeachment. I had to go back and study something I'd never studied at law school, even Harvard Law School, which is what a high crime and misdemeanor is and what the background is of the impeachment section of the Constitution and why it was put there. And it wasn't until the wiretapping scandals became public and that you saw that the President of the United States, and it wasn't anybody else, it wasn't an aide, it was the President of the United States saying, I am above the law, and it doesn't matter what the law says. As Commander-in-Chief, I can do what I want to do. At that point, I saw such a threat to our democratic system that there is no real alternative other than impeachment. Impeachment was a power granted by the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, who thought long and hard about checks and balances. And while they set up a very strong executive and they had all kinds of checks in terms of congressional power over the purse and so forth and so on, they still understood that a president could, even in that four-year term, so threaten the democracy and so become like a tyrant that they granted the power of impeachment and removal. They knew that people in power could abuse that power. And so the impeachment is there. It's not to be used lightly. It has to be done in a fair and judicious and responsible fashion, as was done during the Nixon impeachment, which has withstood the test of time. It was done in a bipartisan way. But, you know, Vice President Gore said we should have a special prosecutor look at what President Bush did. Well, let's assume President Bush may have committed a crime. He can't be prosecuted as president, or there's a serious question as to whether he can be prosecuted as a president, and that doesn't remove him from office. The danger that he has now created is that he's told the American people, I am above the law. I'm above the wiretapping law. By the way, I'm also above the McCain law, the anti-torture law that was just passed, he said in his signing statement. I don't have to obey that either.
Well, the Geneva Convention.
How do you protect yourself against this? How do you reinstitute a system in which everyone obeys the law in this country?
Now, let's start out by let's kind of do this in kind of a reverse fashion, because the issue of the National Security Agency domestic surveillance scandal is most fresh in people's mind, but it's far from the only impeachable offense that could be brought against the Bush administration.
That's correct.
Now, the administration basically says there's two reasons why it is able in the NSA instance to break the law. First, commander-in-chief conducting military activities during a quote-unquote time of war. And the second is that, well, actually, let's get to the second afterward, because it's its own long thing.
Right.
So, commander-in-chief, time of war. What are the courts said about a president's power in a time of war?
Well, let's go back to the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a wonderful quote from Justice Jackson, who's one of the most admired judges on the Supreme Court. And he actually was one of the, I think, the chief U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. And let's go back to the Korean War. There was a strike going on at steel mills, and President Truman said, look, I need to have steel for the bullets, for the tanks, for the guns, for the armaments, for our weapons. We cannot tolerate the steel strike, and I'm taking over these steel strikes, the steel mills, and they're going to produce steel. I'm commander-in-chief. And the Supreme Court said, uh-uh, you can't seize the steel mills. And Justice Jackson had a wonderful statement, which was, the president is only commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. He is not commander-in-chief of the country. Mm-hmm. And I think presidents have to understand, yes, they are commander-in-chief, but they still don't have total control over our country. We still have the rule of law. It's an important quote, something that's stuck in my mind, but for a president to say that he's got inherent power, the argument could be that he has inherent power when we are immediately under attack or we have to repel an imminent attack and there's no time to get congressional approval or disapproval. But when Congress has spoken, when Congress says this is how we want it done, the president can't override that. That's as though the president came to the Congress and said, I want to go to war with the Congo. And Congress says, no. He says, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. I'm commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. Well, the president doesn't have all the powers, even if he's commander-in-chief. He doesn't have all the powers. Congress has been involved in funding wars and making all kinds of decisions with respect to wars. So the president's power, even with regard to being commander-in-chief, is not unilateral. And it's particularly not unilateral where there's a law saying this is how you have to conduct it, period. And so that's the difficulty I see with their argument. And their second argument is that, oh, Congress actually did give us the power to do this. And that's through some amazing, what I would call pretzel kind of, yeah, got into a pretzel shape to figure out how to construe this statute.
This one's beautiful.
Yeah, they say basically because Congress authorized the president to use all necessary force in connection with the war in Afghanistan or against al-Qaeda, that they overrode the wiretapping law. But that's nonsense. And let me go back to some history here about the wiretapping law.
Mm-hmm.
That was enacted against a background of two very important things. One is Richard Nixon himself claiming national security. I'm commander-in-chief. We've heard that one.
Mm-hmm.
As commander-in-chief, I can wiretap whom I want. And he wiretapped 17 newspaper reporters and White House staffers. The House Judiciary Committee looked at that and said, this isn't national security. This is political. And that was one of the grounds for his impeachment. And it had a bipartisan majority of the House Judiciary Committee voting for the president's impeachment for these illegal wiretaps that he claimed were national security, but that was a false claim. So the second thing was that there had been revelations in the mid to late 70s, about huge domestic surveillance that was illegal by the National Security Agency, by the CIA, by the FBI, you name it. And so Congress said, you know, Congress said two things. You know, the country does need national security wiretaps. We know that they could be foreign governments, foreign agents, foreigners who want to do the country harm. And so we have to be able to wiretap to prevent that. But because we've seen this power abused, we're going to set up a special court approval process. In other words, we're not going to trust a president to just say, oh, this is national security, and do it on his or someday her own. No way. And so it's inconceivable to me that Congress, in this Congress or any other Congress, in light of that past history, would ever say a president could do it on his own say-so. And so Congress did not, by granting president right to use force abroad, overrule this statute. And there's Thomas Daschle, who was the Senate Majority Leader and negotiating with the White House, said that was the farthest thing from anybody's mind. And in fact, I believe that the administration knew that it could never get that law changed.
Well, and actually, they had preliminary talks regarding changing the FISA law, and were told not to even think about it because it would not happen. And so I just want to elaborate a little more on the second legal argument regarding the authorization for the use of military force in the war on terror.
Right.
So
there is none.
They're claiming that all necessary force means anything Bush can think up and the Justice Department can justify. However, they went to Congress to try and get the military force resolution to be used domestically. Congress shot it down.
That's correct. So they actually did try that. There's
right.
No question. You're absolutely right about that. And I cite that in my article.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that the legislative history is clear on the subject that the authorization of use of force against al-Qaeda did not authorize them to break the FISA law. And the interesting thing is that now Attorney General Gonzalez, who was the author of this, is now saying, well, it's not a speed issue exactly. We don't have a rationale for why they don't want to go to the courts. But now he's saying, well, you know, the whole process, we've got to get our act together. We've got to show the courts that this is really justified. Hello? That's exactly the whole point.
Right.
The whole point of having FISA was it grew out of the experience of overwhelmingly unjustified domestic surveillance and a president who lied to the American people repeatedly, claiming something was national security when it wasn't. The Congress fully well understood. We have legitimate national security needs, and we're going to create a system that's going to allow national security concerns to be followed and at the same time to prevent wholesale violation of Americans' rights and to prevent presidents from abusing the power of their office. And so I have not seen any rationale that would allow the president to say, I am above the law. If for one second he thought that that law did not protect the American people, he should have gone to the U.S. Congress. He knows how to try to get a law through, and he could say, we've got to have this law changed. He never did, and he didn't do that because he knew Congress wouldn't change the law, and he also didn't want the American people to know he was snooping on them. And this last argument that we would have to make our case to the judges and we might not be able to, but that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. If there is no national security reason, they shouldn't be out there wiretapping.
Right. Just because you don't think that the folks in charge would authorize something doesn't mean that you automatically have the ability to just do it.
That's right. And the purpose of this court system was to accommodate national security needs, create a special court, make it an accelerated process, even allow the president on his own say-so for 3 days to go ahead and wiretap without court order. Mm-hmm. But you have to come back and show somebody that it's justified.
Right.
And that's all we're asking of the president, just to show that it's justified, not to his flunkies, not to his yes people, but to an independent court. If it's justified, the court's going to definitely say yes. There's no question about that. Out of more than 10,000 requests for wiretaps under this order, I think only 4 have been turned down. I mean, this court is not going to turn down a legitimate wiretap request. The problem, I suggest, is that maybe these wiretap requests weren't legitimate, and that's the danger. It's not as though this is hypothetical. We saw that in Watergate. We saw how a president, using the term national security, which is a serious term, we all want our safety protected. To abase that term by using claiming national security when it was actually plain old politics.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman about impeachment. She is a practicing attorney, and back in her first term of Congress, when she was elected in 1972, she actually sat on the House Judiciary Committee when Richard Nixon was impeached. Now, Alberto Gonzalez, in his role as Attorney General after the New York Times very belatedly broke this story in December of 2005, conceded, and it's been written up everywhere, that the type of wiretapping they're doing, quote, requires a court order. Now, how the Attorney General, who's in charge of defending this program, would actually let slip the fact that, oh yeah, you know, it does require a court order. And then Bush in 2004, earlier when he was speaking in Buffalo, he mentioned that a wiretap requires a court order, talking in specific about FISA courts. And he said, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so, in reference to wiretapping. So,
in reference to fighting terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So now, of course, what President Bush is saying, well, I didn't really mean that. I was really talking about the Patriot Act. But, you know, the fact that he would mislead the American people about his intentions with regard to wiretapping is not a good sign for the claim that these are national security based. And it's not a good sign when a president says, I am not going to subject myself to, despite what the law says, to any scrutiny by independent third parties. That scrutiny was developed out of some very bad experiences in the United States when we saw a president and executive agencies run amok. And that's what impeachment was designed to prevent. When an executive thinks he's got all the power and is answerable to no one and is above the law, there is no other remedy in our system. There is no other remedy. Regrettably, that's the remedy.
Well, let's use that concept of deliberately misleading the American public and others as grounds for an impeachable offense by looking at the issue of the invasion of Iraq. It has been more than sufficiently documented that, in fact, the entire premise, depending on which, it doesn't even matter which one you look at, because the administration, when one didn't look quite as strong, they'd throw another one up. All of them turned out to, in fact, be bold-faced lies. And this has been documented. And so, again, you know, this is another aspect of what could definitely be viewed as a high crime or misdemeanor, I feel.
Well, let's go back to what a definition of a high crime and misdemeanor is, because I think a lot of people don't really aren't familiar with it, and that's a good thing. It shouldn't happen every day in our country that we have to use that term. Under the Constitution, the president can be impeached and removed from office for treason, for bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, high crime and misdemeanor, it's not clear what that term means. We spent a lot of time during the Nixon impeachment process trying to analyze it, trying to understand it. I had to go back to all these old dusty tomes because it comes from ancient English practice. And what a high crime and misdemeanor means, it's not necessarily a criminal act. It could be, but it doesn't have to be. Nixon's wiretapping may not have been a crime, but it was an abuse of power. And that's what a high crime and misdemeanor means. It means something that could or could not be a crime, but that is an enormous abuse of power, so much so that it threatens our basic democracy. If you go to war, as we did in with respect to Iraq, on a basis of false statements, and statements that now look as though they were deliberately false, then that is something that threatens our democratic system. People in a democracy get a say in the critical decisions over their lives and over their country. There is no more critical, no graver decision than the decision about going to war. And so if you're given, if the people of this country and the Congress of this country are given false information, they can't make an intelligent, rational decision about going to war. It may be, after all the facts had come out, the American people would say, yeah, sure, let's, and the Congress would have said, let's still go to war with Iraq. But the failure to give the truth to the Congress and the American people shows contempt for the democratic process, and again, shows an effort to subvert the democratic process, and I think threatens, in the most profound way, our system of government, because you're risking people's lives, you're taking people's lives, American lives as well as foreign lives, and you're diverting huge sums of money to a war cause on a basis of things that may not be true, and in fact turned out not to be true. There's no question that the administration knew well that there was no connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and yet that was one of the basic arguments about why we needed to go into Iraq, and that was payback for 9/11. He was responsible for the attacks on 9/11, therefore he should be removed from power. But that was just wholly made up out of thin air. And then the other main argument was that there was a mushroom cloud, that Saddam had nuclear weapons and those were threatening to the United States. Well, that was completely untrue, totally made up. There might have been the argument about other weapons of mass destruction, biological weapons, or chemical weapons. First of all, Saddam had no means of delivering them to the United States. But in any case, there was so much information that showed that that wasn't the case. It seems quite clear now that the president made up his mind early in his administration to go after Saddam Hussein. And regardless of the facts, it's still not clear to me why he wanted to do that. But certainly the facts he gave to the American people were untrue and don't seem to be the real reason. And there's a confirmation in British sources, as many of your listeners will know. The chief of British intelligence went to the United States in the summer of 2002 and came back and reported to a meeting of high security types, including the prime minister in Britain. And there was a memorandum made of that meeting, an official memorandum, and that memorandum says that the intelligence chief told the prime minister of Britain that the Americans had already decided on going to war with Iraq and they were going to fix the intelligence around the policy. In other words, they were going to make up the arguments to go to war.
There's several other aspects of the Iraq war that relate to impeachable offenses. There's the entire issue of torture and the withdrawal, or I guess practical withdrawal from the Geneva Conventions. There's issues related to the United Nations Charter. Domestically, there's the War Crimes Act of 1996. There's violations of the United Nations Charter. And for folks out there who are a little uncomfortable about the concept of, you know, quoting international legal documents, anything that the United States signs as a treaty has the force in law of the United States Constitution. Article 6, Section 2 says that. So the Geneva Conventions legally has the same weight as the United States Constitution. Bush also withdrew very, very early in his first term from the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Now, you're a lawyer, Elizabeth. The Senate ratifies all treaties. Therefore, can only the Senate withdraw from a treaty?
Well, that's a complicated question, and I don't really want to get into that now.
But the president sure
can. But the point is also the Geneva Conventions spell out a mechanism for withdrawing from them, which was not followed. But equally important is that there's a U.S. law that was passed in 1996 designed to carry out the Geneva Conventions, and it makes it a U.S. crime for a U.S. national, military or civilian, to engage in torture, or to murder, or to treat, to engage in inhuman treatment of any detainee, and it applies to those who give the orders as well as to those who take them. And that means that even the President of the United States could be guilty of violating that law if he ordered or tolerated the inhuman treatment or the torture of detainees. And I point out in my article in The Nation that there's a serious suggestion that he did this because he was given by, again, Alberto Gonzalez, a written memorandum spelling out that U.S. officials could be guilty under this law with respect to the treatment of detainees in Afghanistan. And the president, instead of stopping that, which he was obliged to do under Geneva Conventions and the U.S. War Crimes Act, opted out of the Geneva Conventions to allow these people who were engaged in abuse to continue the abuse. And that itself may be a violation of the War Crimes Act of 1996, which is a U.S. law and is a felony. And so there, so that could amount to an impeachable offense as well as a criminal offense. That needs to be fully investigated, and the president's role needs to be fully examined. But if he did condone or order the torture or inhuman treatment of detainees by American soldiers, then or military officials or people or the CIA or any contract agency, then he could be guilty of a U.S. crime.
Now, we've just got a minute left here, and I want to kind of end where we began, which is referencing similarity to Nixon and Watergate. You wrote in your article that you've now got the same sinking feeling in your stomach as you did during Watergate. I read the articles of impeachment that you helped pass back in July of 1974 to impeach, or to forward to the full House to impeach Richard Nixon. I underlined many sections of all three articles that are identical to activities currently taking place. Have you looked back at the articles recently?
Well, I did look at them a while ago, but Article 3 wouldn't apply because it was a subpoena. It was President Nixon's refusal to obey the subpoenas of the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment process. But yes, the abuse of power, which was at the center of the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and he resigned rather than face certain impeachment by the House and certain removal by the Senate. And it wouldn't have been a close vote. It would have been overwhelming with maybe one or two holdouts in both houses. It would have been overwhelming. The fact of the matter is that what was proven during the Nixon impeachment process was a huge abuse of power. A president who believed he was above the law, a president who took the law into his own hands, a president who lied repeatedly about that to the American people and tried to subvert our democracy. And ultimately, it was a very sad and sobering thing to have to do, to vote for his impeachment. It was one of the most unpleasant things I ever had to do in my life. And I hoped dearly that this would never have to be done again, that presidents would get the message from that impeachment process that no one is above the law. But I was wrong.
And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join us to talk about impeachment. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman. She's a practicing government relations attorney back in New York. She served on the House Judiciary Committee when Richard Nixon was impeached. And you can find out more about her and her writings by going to the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. Thank you very much for taking some time to join us this morning, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
And as I mentioned, the People Rise Up website has some and will have a whole lot more by the end of Wednesday information connected to both the unitary executive as well as the issue of impeachment. I appreciate you listening to the program. You have any questions, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. People Rise Up website, kboo.fm. I really appreciate you listening to the program, and tell your friends and family that you can listen to this as an archived podcast or MP3 online, clickable through from the People Rise Up website.